Good morning and welcome to Wanda Six, a Black Arts and Culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. We're listening to Nova Lima's Africa Londo, and we have a couple of great interviews in store for you, pre-recorded, but nonetheless timely and provocative. We're going to kick off the show with an interview with director Deepa Dhanraj, whose latest work, Invoking Justice, is a part of CAM Fest, Film, Music, and Food, formerly known as the Asian American Film Festival, and it starts on Thursday, March 14th, and continues through the 24th of March with lots of great films. And we're going to follow that interview, which actually was on the phone, and the director called me from India, where she lives. We're going to follow that with an interview with the jazz professor, Bill Bell, who's going to talk about his spring concert on Sunday, March 17th at Our Lady of Lourdes Church in Catholic Church in Oakland, California. And we're going to top all of that off with an interview with Albert Mozambuco, who is a member of Ladysmith Black Mombasa, and they have a new CD out, Ladysmith Black Mombasa, Singing for Peace Around the World, and it's a live CD, so we're going to play a little music. So we're going to finish up, you didn't get a chance to hear the last of that Nova Lima Africa Londo, which is a wonderful piece. And if you speak Spanish, then you know it's about liberation and Africans from various parts of the diaspora seeking their freedom. So we are going to, as I mentioned, start off with our director. And before that, let me read you a little bit about the film Invoking Justice, which is just, oh my goodness, it's such a great story. There's mystery, and there's the good guys, and there's the bad guys, the good women and the bad guys, and there are also some good guys, too. And it's a mystery because we don't know how these cases are going to come out, and there's some tragedy because everything doesn't always work out for the good of the families that are having the crises. But quite a bit does. In southern India, family disputes are settled by jamaats, all-male bodies which apply Islamic Sharia law to cases without allowing women to be present, even to defend themselves. Recognizing this fundamental inequity, a group of women in 2004 established a women's jamaat, which soon became a network of 12,000 members spread across 12 districts. Despite enormous resistance, they have been able to settle more than 8,000 cases to date, ranging from divorce to wife beatings and brutal murders. Award-winning filmmaker Deepa Dhanraj, who is also known for her film Something Like a War, follows several cases, shining a light on how the women's jamaat has acquired power through both communal education and the leaders' persistent, tenacious, and compassionate investigation of the crimes. In astonishing scenes, we watch the jamaat meetings where women often shout over each other about the most difficult facets of their personal lives. Above all, the women's jamaat exists to hold their male counterparts and local police to account and to reform a profoundly corrupt system which allows men to take refuge in the most extreme interpretation of the Quran to justify violence towards women. And it's really wonderful that we were supposed to have the director on our show on International Women's Day, but because we have a 12-hour time difference, it just didn't work out. But you're going to hear in the interview that the film was actually screened nationally, and so a lot of women were able to see the film. Those women in the film were able to see the film, and women throughout India were able to see the film in men as well, of course, and learn about the Jamaat and these brave women who are literally taking the law into their own hands and have interpreted the Quran and Islamic law and jurisprudence in a more compassionate way, as opposed to a patriarchal interpretation where women are not valued the same as men, which is not Islamic. It's a cultural interpretation. So it's just really a fabulous film. And the protagonist who sort of takes us under her wing, her story is quite provocative as well, when we find out that she is also a victim of the inequities and of the patriarchal system within her own marriage, and she tells us that her husband hasn't worked to support the family in 18 years. So it's quite interesting. This woman has devoted her life to helping other women in the hopes that eventually something might change in her own life. So here is Deepa Dhanraj, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, talking about Invoking Justice. And Invoking Justice is going to screen three times, actually, and the director is not going to be able to make it here, unfortunately. So we're not going to actually, she's not going to be with us in person, but you're going to have her with us in her film. And her film is screening three times. It's going to screen first March 16th, which is a Saturday, at 1 p.m. at the Kabuki Theater. And then it's going to screen Friday, March 22nd at 7 p.m. in Berkeley at the Pacific Film Archive at UC Berkeley. And then on Saturday, it's going to be back in San Francisco on the 23rd of March, 7:15 at New People, which is a small, intimate venue. So the film is in Tamil with English subtitles, and it's the cinematography is outstanding. And we find out more about the cinematographer in our conversation as well. So there are some lapses because the call drops about four times, but when we are talking, it is quite clear, so just hang in there with us. And here is the director, Deepa Dhanraj, talking about Invoking Justice. So pronounce your whole name. I can do Deepa, but I don't know how to pronounce your last name.
Okay. My name is Deepa Dhanraj, and I live and work in Bangalore, South India.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I thought you were, I didn't know that you were, I mean, I know you're in India now, but I didn't know that you live there. Wow, so this is your community that you're writing about, that you're
Hmm? Yes, I mean, not exactly my community, but because these are Tamil women in South India, again.
Uh-huh.
This is in Tamil Nadu, in a small town called Pudukkottai.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I live and work in India, actually, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. This is a really great story. You know, telling us about the Jamaat. You know, the women started to address the inequities in their society around Islamic law. You know, Sharifa law. Tell us. You know, sort of how you came to this story and the wonderful woman who started this organization.
Well, actually, you know, they started the Women's Jamaat in 2004,
mm-hmm.
and I had been hearing through another friend of mine. I had been hearing, you know, there were stories about the kind of work they were doing, and so it was really fascinating, intriguing, and yet, you know, it's almost as if I didn't believe it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I kept thinking, like, you know, is it possible, can Muslim women really take on the community, the men in the community? Can they take on clerics? And I thought, you know, I have to go out there and look at it for myself. And I went to a meeting. I attended one meeting. This was about 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And at the very first meeting, I was just completely blown away. Because to see, you know, their courage, I mean, their strength, and the fact that they were so determined to get justice for women, and also their humor, because they're incredibly funny, they're warm. It just, I mean, for me, it was just an incredible experience. And I knew right then that this is a story. I mean, even in India, most Indians didn't know about the work that these women were doing. And I felt very strongly that I had to go back and find a way to tell those stories, to show those stories, you know?
Mm-hmm. Right. The issues that the women address are, you know, around dowry, harassment, domestic violence, divorce, property disputes, and the women, these courts, they're not like official courts. These are just men in the community that get to make these decisions about these women's lives.
You know, the thing in India is that we have parallel systems of justice.
Mm.
We have civil law, which is actually colonial law, which is the formal system of law with courts and judges and lawyers and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have what another form of law, which we call customary law, which is personal law. So many communities, in fact, in India, are allowed, it's legal for them to practice customary law. So, and they cover mainly family law, you know, things like divorce, maintenance, bigamy, things like that. So it is legal. Both these systems are permitted.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what the Women's Jamaat has done is that traditionally in Muslim communities in Tamil Nadu, their affairs are administered by a group of older Muslim men. And that council is called a Jamaat, you know, and they adjudicate on cases and they are informed by Sharia law. So in what happened in 2004 is that a group of women got really fed up because the rulings of the male Jamaats were extremely anti-women, they're also very corrupt, you know. So a lot of the judge rulings would go against women because these men would be influenced by money. So in 2004, they got fed up and decided, you know, let's set up our own council, which would be an all-woman council. Now, the brilliance of this strategy, of this idea, is that a Jamaat is not forbidden, you see?
Mm-hmm.
But traditionally, it was only made up of men, but the men couldn't turn around and say, you can't have your Jamaat, because a Jamaat is permitted. The radical thing that they did was, once they started adjudicating, actually giving judgments on cases, that's when the men woke up and became really hostile, because their power, their authority was being threatened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So tell us about some of these cases you follow three cases, and maybe you could tell our audience about these women and these cases that you follow, particularly the really sad story of the woman whose daughter was killed by her in-laws.
Mm-hmm.
That was horrible.
Yeah.
She was so young. Was she 17?
No, I think she was younger. I mean,
oh,
you know,
really?
From the photograph, you can see she looks so young.
Yeah.
Well, when I was filming, I was filming for about 2 years.
Okay.
And, you know, I decided very early on that the way to tell the story or to make this film come alive is that you really see the Jamaat at work. You know, you actually see them negotiating between the police, between families, between male Jamaats. And to do that, I just, you know, for almost 2 years, I was going up and down, and just I filmed over 5 cases and then narrowed it down to 3.
Mm-hmm.
And the tragic thing is that while I was filming, I came across, you know, 4 young women who were killed.
Oh.
you know, and they were all within the ages of about 16 to 25. And it was just so almost, you know, like routine, because they would, the kind, the way that the police work, or the way evidence is collected, there's such a callous disregard, you know, even in our criminal justice system. It just doesn't, it's not taken seriously. And I was so appalled by this, and I thought, you know, I should, because given that I'd filmed four cases, I decided that one of the cases should be about this. Mm-hmm. So I have, actually in the first, there is a case of this young girl who was, who eloped and ran away, and then he was married to the man.
Yeah, I thought it was, I didn't quite understand it, that if she eloped, it seems like they would have loved her, and so things should have been great. Uh-oh.
Should I start again?
I was asking you a question. I was wondering why, if the young woman eloped, you know, with her fiancé, I thought that they would, when they came back, that it would have been great for them because they were in love. However, it wasn't. I mean, she was really persecuted in their family. So I didn't understand why he wasn't nice to her if he eloped with her, her husband.
Well, I think, you know, I mean, it's one thing, of course they eloped, but the practice of exchange of wedding gifts and of dowry is so prevalent, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that she came with nothing, his mother and sister really held it against her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they do.
And they were all living together, you know, in one house, and her husband would be away at work during the day, and I think the mother and the sister, you know, they just, they made her life miserable, because it was one way that they thought they could extract something from her parents, you know,
mm-hmm.
if they put enough pressure on her, and that her parents might relent and return the wedding gifts and the dowry. And things, you know, just escalated from there, because her parents, in a sense, had disowned her. And the girl was really trapped because, you know, there was no natal family to return to. And she was stuck in this family, you know, in her husband's family. And that's why in the film, I mean, we also have, like, the Jamaat women who, Hamsun, who handles the case, who gives her analysis of the story. And you know, she also holds the mother responsible. And says, you know, she could have, because there's just a little wall between the houses. I mean, in the film, you could see that exactly next door there.
That's okay. So you were talking about how the mother was held accountable because they disowned their daughter, and they were neighbors, and she could hear them beating her daughter and her daughter crying out, and she didn't do anything because the elders had told them to write her off.
Right. And also I think the mother was afraid of, I think because for the husband it had become a kind of, you know, it had become an ego issue. I mean, that the girl had dared to defy him, and I think the mother was also terrified of going against the husband. So, you know, that's the tragic story, you know. That's the real tragic part of the story, I mean.
Yeah, it is really tragic.
And in the Jamaat meeting, you have women who, you know, when the mother is deposing in the meeting, and I think one woman's, you know, says, you know, we can't disown our daughters. I mean, you know, no matter what they do, you can't write them off.
Yeah.
And this is what actually I found so amazing about the women's Jamaat, that they are they have an amazing ethical and moral compass, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they maintain that kind of that kind of what I call a kind of moral integrity, and hold everybody accountable to ethical behavior, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Even the petitioners who come to them.
Yeah, right. So, is the Jamaat unique to this particular community, or is it in other parts of India?
The thing is that in other parts of India, there are Muslim women's groups,
mm-hmm.
you know, or but they don't adjudicate.
Mm-hmm.
They don't actually try cases, and they don't pass judgments. The only one that does that is this Jamaat in Tamil Nadu.
Right, yeah.
So that aspect of their work is absolutely unique.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in this particular community, could you talk a little bit about this particular community and its uniqueness, not just around the Jamaat, but in other ways
mm-hmm.
that set it off from other parts of India?
Question? You said, can you talk about the community?
Yeah, this particular region of India and what set
uh-huh.
us off from other parts of India. It's a Muslim community. It's in the southern
mm-hmm.
part of India. And this particular community, I mean, I know within Indian culture there are different hierarchies within the various
mm-hmm.
Communities, depending on sort of, you know, what community you were born into. So why don't you tell us a little bit about this community if you could do that. In comparison to, like, the community you were raised in, let's say.
Okay. The thing is that I am a Hindu.
Okay.
I'm not a Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
The community that I was filming, these are Muslims in the southern state of Tamil Nadu. And in this state, Muslim community affairs are adjudicated by Jamaats. This is very particular to Tamil Nadu, to this part of South India.
Mm-hmm.
In other states of the country, the Muslim Jamaats don't have such an important role to play in adjudicating family law. Now, the reason that this community that we were working with, many of them are extremely poor.
Mm.
Many of the men, for about at least 80 to 100 years, have been migrating out of the country for work. They go to the Middle East, or they go to Malaysia, or they go to Singapore to do, you know, basically very low-paid, low-skilled, menial labor. It's a kind of money-order economy. Money is sent home. The women then have to really look after the children, old parents, in-laws. They're really left on their own. I mean, it's a big struggle, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And men may return 2 years, or once in 2 years, once in 3 years. So the women, basically, they try and do, you know, some kind of small trades. You know, to have a little shop, or maybe these very, very modest, very small businesses. But it's hard. I mean, it's really difficult for them to cope. The wealthier people in this community, the wealthier men, for example, are landlords. I mean, they're very successful traders. And the wealthy men are often also male Jamaat leaders, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very feudal society. And these wealthy men are also politically very well connected. They're very well connected with the political parties, with the political and with the civil administration. You know, have very good connections with the police, with administrative officers. So in that sense, they're extremely powerful, you know. So the authority that the male Jamaat commands over the poorer poorer Muslims, and that constituency is huge. And their rulings are really considered inviolable. So this is the way, this is the kind of stranglehold, this is the kind of power that the Muslim Women's Jamaat is trying to challenge. The Women's Jamaat, those women are mostly poor. I mean, a few of them may have, you know, had schooling up to grade 7, some of them up to grade 10, but those are very few. But the majority of the members are really not literate, but extremely extremely knowledgeable, extremely sharp, and extremely good at negotiating between civil law and Sharia law.
Is there a difference?
Did I answer your question?
Yeah.
Sorry,
yeah.
Was that too long?
No. Yeah. Yes, you did. And I was just looking at where Tamil Nadu is in India, and it's around the tip, you know, the southernmost tip, and it's right on, it seems like it's really beautiful. It's right on the water. Wow, so it's really amazing that the women have been able to establish, you know, this Jamaat and prosecute, given the dynamics, you know, within their community. I was wondering for you, which film is this for you, and is it typical of you to make films that look at, you know, women in your country and ways in which they're challenging sort of structural systems that oppress them?
Well, you know, I've been making films for over 30 years now.
Oh, wow. that's great.
And I actually started making films. I was a very active member of the Indian women's movement, and I've been a feminist. I'm still a feminist,
yes.
And my work, so a lot of my work has had to do with, you know, issues that women face and the kind of challenges that women have posed to structural inequity. So some of my films have been on, you know, the politics of population control, women's political participation, women and the law, women who have been fighting as environmentalists. So these are some of the subjects that I have dealt with. So I like to make films that are not victim stories. I'm interested in sort of unlocking or unmapping the kind of context in which inequity exists, but simultaneously showing very powerful ways in which ordinary women have managed to politically mobilize and change things. And I'd say that this film, Invoking Justice, just falls in that kind of, that's the continuum of my work. And this is a very good example of the kind of work that I have been doing for all this time.
Yeah, wow. So where does this desire to represent women and tell these stories that, you know, otherwise might not be known? Because you mentioned that this particular story was one that most of India didn't know about. Where does this desire come from, and sort of, you know, where is your support to tell these kind of stories? Because I'm sure it's not easy, and often not necessarily safe for you to go into these particular situations and bring out these particular stories, because there could be opposition.
Well, I think the opposition is not really so much for us. I think the women there and on the ground, what they face, they're the ones who struggle with this, you know, on a daily basis. But I think my desire to do this is because I just feel that, you know, there is a way in which It's political. If I have to look at it, it's like a political initiative for me, you know. I think it's a way of intervening politically, that you demonstrate the potential and the power that ordinary women have. And that's a way that you get people to rethink, you know, to rethink their assumptions, rethink the stereotypes of Muslim women, all these things, you know. So for me, that's really the attention, my intention, is that how do you represent these voices that really go against the grain, you know, of everything that people believe in. And I think it's very important. For example, on International Women's Day, March 8th, there's a sort of national TV channel in India, and they decided to show this story on International Women's Day.
Oh,
you know?
Great.
And it was fantastic because I had told all the Jamaat women this is going to happen and you have to put on your TV sets, you have to watch.
Uh-huh.
And for it to be on a national channel, you know, not just on a state channel. And it was fantastic because the kind of responses that, you know, they got for their work, it was just so moving. It was just, you know, you just feel fantastic when that happens, you know.
Oh, that's,
and in a sense, they felt great because, you know, this is okay. It's not just there in the small town and working in these 8 or 10 districts, but suddenly people get a chance to see what they're doing.
Oh, that's really great! Congratulations. Yeah, we were supposed to speak on International Women's Day, and I was thinking how apropos because I was getting emails about signing petitions ending violence against women in India, and I'm like, oh well, and I just finished watching a film about the court system like set up by women.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah.
Yeah,
that's pretty amazing.
But, are you, Wanda? Are you a Muslim?
Yes, I am. Yeah.
Okay, what did you think of it?
Oh, I just thought it was great, and it's really interesting that you know, this woman's Jamaat in India. It would be great if such systems were replicated in other places because it is a real male-dominated system, and it's, you know, not just in India, throughout the world.
I have to tell you that, you know, the other thing that really drew me to this subject very strongly is that these are women of faith, and they're not, you know, and they're working from within the faith to correct what they see, to demand what they think the Quran what the Quran intended for women in the best sense.
Right.
And this fascinated me as well. You know, this is not, in a sense, outsiders, you know, secular feminist women who are doing this. These are women who are doing it from within Islam. And I think this is very important for people to know.
Yeah, definitely. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I was looking at your bio, and I noticed that there's another film about women in the law, Nari.
Adalat, right.
Yeah,
yes.
Women's Courts. Is that like a parallel kind of story, but not set within the Muslim community?
Exactly, right. It's a similar kind of, you know, alternative conflict. It's called alternative conflict dispute resolution, where, you know, you sit around and you try and create a negotiation space. But these Hindu women, and it's not necessarily, I was interested in that because they were seeking gender justice for women, but it's much more secular. It hasn't got anything to do with any religious orientation. So that was different. But to get back to this film, I have to tell you that the what we're really trying to do, because the film has been it's been seen internationally, you know, by different people in different places, and so I've got some kind of inquiries, you know, people. I mean, there are grassroots women's groups, for example, in Saudi Arabia, in Jordan.
Oh, super.
In Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
And who are really interested in getting copies. Of course, they'd have to be dubbed into those languages, but mm-hmm. they really want copies to use them in their work with Muslim women's groups. So this is something really exciting. I'm really looking forward to,
mm-hmm.
you know, what will happen, and the film's going to have that kind of, you know, a kind of advocacy role.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's going to be really interesting.
Oh, that's really wonderful. And I, you know, that's a really wonderful compliment to your filmmaking, that this story is one that this film is being used as like an organizing tool internationally.
Mm-hmm.
That's excellent. That's really excellent. Congratulations. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about Sharifa, you know, the woman who is, you know, a longtime feminist, who mm-hmm. You know, who leads the group, and her story is interesting, because I thought, wow, she's talking about how these inequities have been normalized. It was just, that's just the way it is, and
mm-hmm.
and I just thought about how we get used to such things. You know, things that are wrong become something that is just, you know, the way we've been used to accepting certain kinds of behaviors and treatments, and so they don't get challenged until, you know, someone like her says, no, this
mm-hmm.
isn't right, and this is not what Allah says in the Quran, and so we need to change this, which takes a lot of courage.
Yes. You know, she's a remarkable woman. I mean, I think in her personal life, because her father died young, and you know, she was raised by her mother, and then the
So you were talking about Sharifa?
Yeah, so I think she was very, you know, she had a very domineering older brother who was very controlling.
Mm.
And so even as a young girl, as a young woman, intuitively she knew that it was unjust, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she had experienced growing up in a really patriarchal and controlling family. And though she knew intuitively that it was unjust, and she could see in society all around her that this is going on, I think it was later that when she got exposed to, as she says in the film, and, you know, when she went to a women's meeting, it was a kind of conference, and then for the first time, when she got to hear the way women activists are speaking about violence against women, that she suddenly got a kind of political framework in which to place her experience.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think there was a huge shift in her thinking. And when she came back and she started mobilizing Muslim women, that was a kind of very radicalizing experience. And when she came back, and then it's just through working, you know, it's just through working, organizing women getting together, speaking about what's happening to them, and trying to understand what was going on, you know, with how they were being treated. And I think these, suddenly there was a form in which a space and a place to speak about this. And then I think Sharifa, it was kind of her very brilliant idea, you know, saying, like, let's start looking at Sharia law, let's start looking at how male jamaats work, and she facilitated all those things. So then when there was a sort of suggestion that they come up with this women's jamaat, she also had the vision, if you like, to see how it could be done.
Mm-hmm.
So she's really the linchpin in that sense, you know. And also she's a graduate, so she knows, she knows how to work with other political groups, you know, in the state. So
mm-hmm.
other feminist groups, or whether they're human rights groups. So these are the kind of political alliances and connections that she uses also to support and defend the women's jamaat work. So she's very crucial in that sense.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. I was also looking at this particular place that it has, you know, really beautiful architecture, Tamil Nadu, with regards to, you know, temples and other types of architectural kind of beauty and wonders, and that the Muslim population is really small compared to the Hindu population there. And I was wondering, I've also just from other films and other people I've spoken to, that there's a community of African descent in the southern part of India. Is it in this particular part as well?
No, it's not here. It's partly in Karnataka and a little bit in Gujarat. And they're known as Siddhis, you know.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But they must have been in, because there's been so much trade by sea, and so what people suspect is that there were probably slaves who were brought over, you know, maybe, I don't know, even in the 16th, 17th century.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. Are you working on any other films now?
Right now, no.
Okay.
Right now, no. I'm just, I have some ideas, but no, nothing has, you know, nothing's really firmed up in that sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. India is known for its filmmaking. You know, there. You know, India has a lot of great filmmakers, and it has a huge film industry. Has that helped you with regards to making your films, having those kind of resources? Is it easier for you to make films than being somewhere else where there wasn't that kind of industry or support financially, or can you tap into that particular type of resources for the type of stories that you tell?
No, because the Indian film industry is basically fiction film. Fiction feature films,
yeah.
And they're sort of very, it's very hard. Actually, it's not easy for documentary filmmakers in India to raise resources because we don't really have institutional funding.
Mm-hmm.
So it's always a challenge to figure out how to raise resources to make documentaries. And then we have two TV stations. There's only one that, so it's not, they don't show documentaries that often, so we don't have such a good distribution system as well.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not easy here to make documentaries.
Mm, wow.
So though we have this huge industry,
yeah,
it's it only works for fiction film, and that to a very particular kind of fiction film, you know, like Bollywood. I mean, those kind of blockbuster extravaganza, that kind of work. So, for example, in India, you can't release a documentary theatrically. Some people have tried, but it's not a routine, you know?
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. So it's real wonderful that your film had such a great national screening on Friday of last week. That's great.
Yeah, that was great. That was really great, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, wow, that is amazing. Well, it's really wonderful that the San Francisco Bay Area is going to be able to see your film, Invoking Justice. I see this weekend and the week after that. It really has three screenings, so that's really exciting for us. And then your film is having a theatrical release on ITVS, which is really wonderful. Mm-hmm. It's going to have an even, you know, broader debut. When it hits ITVS on national public broadcasting. So that's great.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I really wish I could be there. I really wish I could be there too.
Yeah.
You know, in the audience to see how people react and stuff. But be exciting, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, these women, I mean, the filming, I mean, the cinematography is just beautiful. It's just the colors are so rich and the stories are so compelling. It was just a beautiful film as well as a real compelling one.
Oh, thank you. Thanks a lot. The cinematography is by my husband. He's the Navroz contractor.
Really?
And he's a really senior, very experienced cinematographer in India.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, has done a lot of work, and so he's done the camera.
Oh.
For the film. Yeah.
Okay. Wow. So you have it's like a family affair.
Yes. Yeah, right.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for this wonderful conversation. I really appreciate, you're getting in touch with us and calling us all the way from India. What time is it there for you?
It's 8 at night, yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, about 12 hours difference.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Okay, thank you so much, Wanda.
Thank you. Good luck on this film as it travels throughout the world and women use it as an organizing tool. And good luck on your next work. And, wow, 30 years, that's quite a commitment. That's wonderful. You don't look like you could have been making films for 30 years.
You're great. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. You take good care.
Yeah, you too. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye. That was a wonderful conversation with a fabulous director, Deepa Jainraj. And the jazz professor, Bill Bell, as he's known, grew up in the small Midwestern town of East Moline, Illinois, located west of Chicago on the banks of the Mississippi River. Historic jazz greats Bix Biederbeck and Louis Belson hail from the same Quad City area. He was born to a highly musical family in that his uncle played trumpet with the Cab Calloway Band. His first cousin and clarinet saxophonist was his high school band director, and his mother played the piano. As I mentioned already, Professor Bell is going to be talking about this tradition. He has a concert that he's been hosting with his Oakland Community Choir for quite a while now, and he's going to tell us about how that choir developed, and he's going to talk about his musical career growing up in the small town East Moline, which is one of the Quad Cities. I think there are like four cities that sort of are around the Mississippi River. Like, you never think about the Mississippi River north. You think about the Mississippi River in the south, and that Mississippi River is quite like the Nile River. It doesn't flow south to north, but it does have a long trajectory and hits a whole lot of different places. It's unfortunate that the history of the people don't travel with the river as well, because he's going to talk about how he didn't know that much about Black history until he I think he said until he came to California, and that is really amazing. what else I want to tell you about Professor Bell? I want to mention to you that, he earned the title Jazz Professor for completing over 30 years of successful university and college jazz teaching. He was chairman of the music department at the College of Alameda for the last 20 years of his tenure there, and he's widely known for his directing of award-winning jazz bands and small ensembles at both the College of Alameda and Stanford University. He also held an adjunct position in jazz improvisation at the University of California, Berkeley. He was awarded the Beacon Award from the San Francisco Jazz for outstanding contribution to jazz education and performance in 2005. With a proven background in jazz education, he maintains a busy schedule of workshops and lecture demonstrations with his trio and quartet, The Jazz Connection. And he's also been churning out those CDs. You know, we got to have product, right? So it's been a minute since he's had a new CD. So hopefully, perhaps And there, and he has actually recorded the ensemble we're going to be hearing. But perhaps another CD is in the works. So here, without further ado, is Bill Bell. So I wanted to maybe start out, Professor Bell, also known as the jazz professor. Perhaps you could tell us about this wonderful concert that you're having this Sunday.
I'd be happy to, Wanda. Thank you for having me. And the opportunity is mine to tell about some of the history, the important history of the African American spiritual. The Oakland Bay Area Community Course, of which I'm the director, is a course that focuses on the preservation of the African American spiritual as it was first developed in slavery, during the time of slavery, and further refined by black colleges. Like Fisk University, Tuskegee University, and others. So that's really the music that we will be featuring on Sunday. Mm-hmm. It's four-part harmony, sometimes six-part harmony, without instrumental accompaniment. Mm-hmm. However, we will be doing some gospel and some gospel rock as well with the jazz. Trio.
So we're talking about the Negro spiritual, and that goes back to the enslavement of our people, and we talk about the coded language and how it was like, you know, this is where, you know, they talk about the Navajo code talkers. Well, this precedes that.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, and so I was wondering if you could talk a bit about the differences between the Negro spirituals and gospel, because you mentioned gospel and you mentioned gospel rock. Like, what's that?
Uh-huh. Well, I choose to call it African-American spiritual just not because we're referring to the same music.
Okay.
Because the word Negro, I have a problem with it because it does not refer to any geographical area as far as people is concerned.
Right.
And so we think of it as a very special type of music which comes out of the African tradition. Much of it is built on the same scale as the African pentatonic scale, which is a five-tone scale. Mm-hmm. In fact, much of our music, African American music, in general, all the way up to jazz, through popular and gospel styles, are built on this particular scale. What sets it apart is that it is a type of music that was refined, conceived during the time of slavery from 18, well, we really do have to say from the time that the slaves were allowed to practice Christianity until the present time. The black colleges took over after 1865 and refined the style to what has now become the African American spiritual.
Wow. You have a real illustrious career as an educator. I hadn't realized that you had also taught before you came here in the public schools, and then you're really well known for teaching at the College of Alameda,
uh-huh,
and retiring there as the head of the department.
Yeah.
And you know, that's where you get the jazz professor, you know, title from. And I was wondering, I was just thinking about you and Ed Kelly at Laney and David Hardiman, senior at City College. At one point, you all were running things, right?
Yes. Well, we were the jazz pioneers, so to speak, that came in. Ed actually was teaching before I was. I think he was teaching during the late 60s, and I started at Alameda in 1970 when the college opened. David Hardiman was one of my recruits who was teaching in the public school system in Indianapolis, and we recruited him out to teach first in Berkeley, and then he came over to the College of Alameda, and now, you know, he has retired from the San Francisco community college system.
Right. Yeah. Could you talk for a minute about musical education? You seem like, you know, you came up in a musical family, and you know, your family realized that, you know, just by, you know, listening to you play the piano by ear, that you were a prodigy. Yet, you didn't start out playing the piano. You started out playing the trombone, which is kind of interesting.
That's not really accurate.
Okay. I was like, I didn't know you played the trombone, too.
Yeah. I started out playing by ear, because my mother played by ear.
Oh.
And I would listen to what she would, she played the old hymns, and she was a very fine singer as well.
Mm-hmm.
And she discovered when I was about 5 years old that I could pick out the hymns on the piano. And she said, oh, no, you're not just going to play by ear. We're going to get lessons for you. Mm-hmm. And so at a real expense for my family, I was given lessons as an early, of a young child, 5 or 6, and started my musical career there.
Mm-hmm.
You talked about my musical family.
Yeah.
My uncle was a trumpet player and played for a little while with Cab Calloway.
Mm-hmm.
And actually my first cousin, who was really my major mentor, he taught me my first music lessons and theory. And I always wanted to be like him. He was also my high school band director.
Mm-hmm.
So I started studying trombone under him as a youngster in high school. I think I was a sophomore in high school when I started playing the trombone.
Mm-hmm.
I'd been playing the piano for a number of years.
Oh, okay. So that was your second instrument?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Could you talk to us about sort of what it was like? I didn't know. I never heard of East Moline, Illinois. and then where you went to school, Rock Island, Illinois. Like all these interesting names.
Yeah. You grew up out here, is that right?
Yeah. My family's from New Orleans, but I grew up in San Francisco. Mm-hmm.
Well, East Moline and Rock Island, they're located in the middle, right in the middle of the country, right on the Mississippi River.
Oh, really?
Grew up there. A place, it's actually called the Quad Cities, where there are four cities that are built right on the river. East Moline, Rock Island, Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
And then across the river is Davenport, Iowa.
Okay.
So that's the area from which I come.
Mm-hmm.
And had my early experiences in that area, which was a rich area in music.
Mm-hmm.
So we had Augustana College, which my cousin had gone to, and I followed in his footsteps later on and was a music major there as well.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. I was wondering when I was reading, you know, that among others, Louis Belson is also from that area.
Yes,
yeah.
Moline,
yeah. Did you know him when he was there, or did you even consider that you would be playing together later on? When
no, I did not know him. He had left and was really developing his career at by the time that I. I was 15 or so and started really playing music.
Mm-hmm.
But it so happened that his father owned the music store in Moline.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to know his brother, Tony Belson, and played with him in the area.
Mm-hmm.
My father actually took lessons from the Belson music store. My father was an amateur guitar banjo player,
mm-hmm.
rather than the guitar.
Yeah.
His roots were in Louisiana as well.
Oh, okay.
And grew up in a little town, I think it was north of Alexandria, Louisiana,
mm-hmm.
called Gina.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, interesting. Wow. So, yeah, the banjo, you know, that we could trace that back to Africa.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Wow. So your father was, you know, really, literally, you know, sort of playing roots music.
Yeah. We didn't know at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, one of the tragedies of growing up was that you learned very little about African American history.
Hmm.
It was not taught in the schools, and no notion of any kind of major contribution that we had made to this country other than being slaves.
Hmm.
There was no mention of Frederick Douglass, Harriet Tubman, and some of the other real heroes,
mm-hmm.
That black children could identify with and really become interested in the area of history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was just thinking about Illinois, because there is a really famous African American who I think laid out the state or laid out the city, you know.
DeSable.
Yeah, DeSable, yeah. You didn't know about him?
No,
wow.
We did not know. Unless you grew up in Chicago.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Because there was a DeSable High School.
Mm-hmm.
In Chicago, but not much was mentioned about his contribution,
mm-hmm.
to that area. In fact, that was the time when all of our contributions were played down. Our recordings were separated from the mainstream.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very oppressive time in our history.
Yeah, wow. Is this one of the reasons why when you discovered jazz at 13, was that why it was so monumental? Because with that discovery came, you know, all this historical information that you hadn't necessarily knew before?
Well, actually, I didn't get the historical piece until I had graduated from college and moved to through this area.
Really?
Yes. It was just incredible. There is a very gifted and brilliant arranger of spirituals by the name of Nathaniel Dett, that I never knew that he existed until I came to this part of the country. However, the chorus at Augustana College sang one of his major pieces and had it as their main repertoire, Listen to the Lambs. It really made me quite angry to know that all of this important history had been discarded and taken away from the notification of all people, not just black people, but everybody should have known who that man was.
Yeah.
And by the way, we're going to sing one of his pieces this Sunday.
Oh, that's great. Which one?
Mm-hmm. It's called I'll Never Turn Back No More.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah. When the first time I saw you in concert, you were doing one of the Ellington Sacred concerts for San Francisco Jazz. And
oh,
I think it was Jazz Festival back then.
Oh.
And yeah, it was so beautiful. It was at Grace Cathedral.
Oh yeah.
And the conductor from Southern California
Had
come up for that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a really, really wonderful experience.
Mm-hmm.
And Clarence sang?
Pardon me? Say it again.
Clarence Kelly's choir, I think.
They might have. I just remember you.
Oh,
in white,
okay.
In that piano. and I'm trying to think, what's the name of the conductor that came up? His last name was Wilson, I think.
Golly, it's been so long.
Yeah, it was really, like, marvelous. It was in October, and it was just like, I never knew that Duke Ellington had sacred music.
Oh, yeah. See, there
that.
You go.
Yeah. So it was just really, you know, phenomenal. And then one of my colleagues, when I taught at Contra Costa College, she told me about your community, Oakland Bay Area community chorus, which she was a part of. She was a counselor.
What's her name?
Gosh, I can't remember. Older woman. Yeah, she's since retired. She taught reading. And it's like, wow, you've done so much. I mean, as you were teaching, you also you took off time to travel, and just reading some of the people that you've performed with, Carmen McRae and you know, the Supremes. I'm like, oh my goodness.
And
as you're also developing the Stanford University Jazz Band, that's like, wow.
Mm-hmm.
That's just really, really, you know, awesome. So now that your Eddie Marshall has made his transition, who makes up your Jazz Connection trio?
Well, Eddie Marshall is one of those people that is irreplaceable.
Oh, yeah, of course.
And I still miss him, and many of us who worked with him just really miss him terribly. But we have to move on with other people, and I've been playing with a New York drummer by the name of Sly Randolph.
Okay.
And a Chicago-based drummer by the name of, oh gosh, I'll think of his name in a second. blanking out on a name. I'll think of it in just a second.
Sure.
Go ahead.
I like to talk while you're thinking. Okay. Mm-hmm. and over your, you know, your tenure, you know, as an educator, you've had a lot of your students are world renowned.
Yeah. I'm very, very proud of that. Mm-hmm. I'm so proud of that.
Yeah, I didn't know that John Faddis was one of your students.
Yes.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I love his work. He is just phenomenal on that trumpet.
And I was trying to think of the word, of the name, Leon Joyce.
Oh, Leon Joyce, he's great.
Yes, wonderful drummer.
Yeah, he's really awesome. I saw him this past season at the Yerba Buena Garden concerts through Afro Solo. I think he performed with Destiny, Harpist from the Hood. I think he was her drummer.
Okay.
On her concert date. Oh, yeah, he's great. Oh, okay. That should be fun.
Oh, it is.
Yeah. So you've got some of your other renowned students are Benny Green, just really wonderful pianist as well.
Mm-hmm.
Will Kennedy, drummer.
Yeah.
Pianist Michael Wolf and Glenn Pearson, who has taken over your chair.
Yeah.
At the College of Alameda, and is also
so very proud of him.
Yeah. He's done a whole lot. I didn't even realize. I thought he was from New York, but he went to New York.
He's from Oakland, California.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. So could you talk? I know my time is running out. I was wondering if you could talk for a minute about the intersection of you know, art and art and culture and the development of the human being.
Yes. I think as far as being developing as a comprehensive human being,
mm-hmm.
The arts, along with science, is just together. It's they make a very balanced person. So much is concentrated now on the area of economics, business. Money making, the corporate world, and which is only one part of our makeup. It's to leave out the artistic part. That means not only art, not only music. Graphic art, drama,
mm-hmm.
dance, all of those areas are connected because they're areas of expression. And if we leave that out, then we have a person who's like a robot, as far as I'm concerned. And I meet lots of people like that, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
Who are not sensitive to the things that are really enriching.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's really important that we start early with our young people to expose them to live music, not just music that they hear on the radio,
mm-hmm.
but they should see music created by musicians and singers, so that they know that this is music that has to be reproduced by musicians and by human beings, rather than pushing a button or making some kind of a beat. We're being reduced to a very simplified notion of what music is all about. I was talking with one of my former students who is one of the producers and arrangers for the Grammys.
Oh, mm-hmm.
And I was asking him about why so much music that doesn't seem to fit the mold of beautiful music. And he says, well, now the whole thing is to keep it simple. And I said, oh, my God, that means a real reduction from what it was with Duke Ellington, what it was with Frank Sinatra, Joe Williams, Carmen McRae, Sarah Vaughan. And Bird, can't leave Bird out. So I don't know where it's going, but I know that the ingredients that are really in that are found in real music and classical music. That means classical in the sense that it's lasting, not classical as it's since just Bach, Beethoven, and Brahms, but classical music that's universal, that communicates with everyone. Classical dance, classical graphic arts. That has to survive in order for the human species to survive.
We have to, you know, that's interesting how that particular aspect of the conversation around art and education and arts in schools, it gets glossed over that when we deprive, you know, our children specifically of that type of education, we are compromising the future of our you know, our species.
That is a very good word, compromising the very foundation of our species.
Yeah. It's like, oh my goodness. I remember the name of the conductor. His name is Gerald Wilson.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Gerald Wilson is still around.
Yeah, just like you're
he's
still
in
around.
He's in his 90s.
Oh, my God, he's in his 90s now.
Unbelievable.
Yes. Well, you know, I think when you're doing what you love, you know, making art, making things beautiful, you can be around as long as your body holds it together.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So my last question is, I want to let our audience know that this Oakland Bay Area Community Chorus presenting Sing Into Spring, Professor Bill Bell's annual spring concert is happening at the Our Lady of Lourdes Catholic Church, 2808 Lakeshore Avenue in Oakland. That's going to be so beautiful on
Hope
Sunday.
You can come.
Oh, yeah, I plan on doing that. That seems like there's a whole lot happening, but that's the place to be.
Thank you.
Yeah, Sunday, March 17th at 4 p.m., and it's going to feature 50 voices. Is that what you said?
Yeah, we have 45 this time.
45, wow.
Almost 50.
Yeah. Do some of the members go back to the beginning of your, starting the choir?
Yes. Some of them go back to down to Memorial Methodist Church, where the choir was founded. We first began in 1967 when we were asked by Duke Ellington to do his sacred concert.
You were asked by Duke Ellington?
Yes.
You've met Duke Ellington and performed with him?
Worked with him. One of the most exciting times of my career.
Oh, my goodness.
That was so glorious.
Wow.
So we go way back to that time when we were a church choir. Then In 2001, we began to be a community chorus.
Oh, okay. Wow. Well, then you know my friends, Sister Sadie and
William?
Brother Cleophas Williams. Uh-huh.
Oh, they're so beautiful.
Yeah, she just made 90-something.
Yeah, they are staunch, staunch supporters.
Yeah, wow.
They'll be there.
Oh, super. Oh, good, mm-hmm. They're still in town because I know they travel internationally.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. So tickets are $20 for adults and $10 for children. And
yes.
People can call area code 510-283-5003, or for tickets, they can go to brownpapertickets.com.
Right.
Yeah, and Our Lady of the Lord's church has great acoustics. However, it's not, you know, it could sell out.
Yes, it could.
So people should definitely get their tickets in advance.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Wow. Well, I had another question, but it flew out of my mind. So we'll have to have another conversation at another
point.
Well,
it's been a pleasure, Wanda.
Yeah, it's been great.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Oh, well, thank you, and you know, good luck on all the last-minute preparations and
all
that.
You know, that's going on.
All right, we'll see you Sunday.
All right, Wanda, thanks.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Sunburn 9. That's a greeting in our language, isiZulu, meaning hello. The response is yebo. Sanibonani. Beautiful. We thank you all for coming to our show this evening. Ladies Meet Black Mambazo was formed 51 years ago by our leader, Professor B.J. Mshengu Shabalala. And our mission has been to spread our culture, the culture of South Africa, of love, peace, and harmony throughout the world. Your being here this evening continues this journey. We thank you very much. This next song is called Yangi Lumingkuku. It's about a naughty little chicken who won't let us do our work on the farm. This little chicken keeps biting our feet, our ankles, and our legs. Sometimes we get fed up with this little chicken. We wanted to kill it and eat it. Making some buffalo wings with it. But some of us have said, no, it's too small, it won't be enough for the rest of us, so we let it leave. Here's the song, Yangi Lumingkuku.
Yangi Lumingkuku.
Yangi Luma, Yangi Lumingkuku. Yangi Luma, Salamu Enkosi Sabeti. Yangi Luma, Ingoka Namasino. Young Luma, Young Luma,
Young Luma, Salah, Iboni lelo mabantwana
ihlela nasefeni ijabulelo ukhanya welanga njene madoda ngoba futhi yancelisa inobiso lomnandi njengoba nathi sakhula ngobisi nayo beyikhulisa abantwana bayo ngobisi lwayo lomnandi. Hijeni madoda, hijeni madoda, mbeze makasale nkuku. Hijeni madoda,
ndikubisele useni.
Hijeni madoda,
ifunga mazinyo wayo.
Mbeze makasale nkuku.
Amahle amhlophe.
Hijeni madoda,
ndikubisele useni.
Hijeni madoda,
ifunga mazinyo wayo.
Mbeze makasale nkuku.
Amahle amhlophe.
Hijeni madoda,
inobiso lomnandi,
mbeze makasale nkuku.
Ikhulisa abantwana bayo.
Hijeni madoda, hijeni madoda,
inobiso lomnandi,
mbeze makasale nkuku.
Ikhulisa abantwana bayo.
Hijeni madoda, hijeni madoda,
ishona amazinyo wayo,
mbeze makasale nkuku.
Amahle amhlophe.
Hijeni madoda, hijeni madoda,
ishona amazinyo wayo,
mbeze makasale nkuku.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Ladysmith Black Mambazo is a family. In my group, I have four sons, the next generation of Mambazo. They are our future. To sing our next song, welcome my youngest son, Tamsanqa.
I'm doing it.
Of the cipher aspect in hip hop, where instead of you know, using your art, you know, to battle one another. And that goes back to the ring shout of the Africans, enslaved African tradition, when they get together in the woods after they worked all day and they get in a circle and praise, you know, the Creator for another day of life and another day and another opportunity to be free. I'm reading from Mbazo.com, which is their official website. I'm going to continue a little bit, and then I'm going to jump right into the interview. A radio broadcast in 1970 opened the door to their first record contract, the beginning of an ambitious discography that currently includes more than 50 recordings. Their philosophy in the studio was, and continues to be, just as much about preservation of musical heritage as it is about entertainment. The group borrows heavily from a traditional music called Iskatamiya, which developed in the mines of South Africa, where black workers were taken by rail to work far away from their homes and their families. Poorly housed and paid worse, the mine workers would entertain themselves after a six-day week by singing songs into the wee hours on Sunday morning. When the miners returned to the homelands, their musical tradition returned with them. In the mid-1980s, Paul Simon visited South Africa and incorporated Black Mambazo's rich tenor, alto, and bass harmonies into his Graceland album, a landmark 1986 recording that was considered seminal in introducing world music to mainstream audiences. A year later, Simon produced Black Mambazo's first U.S. release, Shaka Zulu, which won a Grammy Award in 1988. Since then, the group has been awarded two more Grammy Awards and have been nominated a total of 15 times, including a nomination for their most recent CD release, Songs from a Zulu Farm. And one of those songs was what we played initially. That's what you heard, the farm animal sounds in the end. In addition to their work with Paul Simon, Ladysmith Black Mambazo has recorded with numerous artists from around the world, including Stevie Wonder, Dolly Parton, Sally McLaughlin, Josh Groban, Emmylou Harris, Melissa Etheridge, and many others. Their film work includes a featured appearance in Michael Jackson's Moonwalker video and Spike Lee's Do It a Cappella. They provided soundtrack material for Disney's The Lion King Part 2, as well as Eddie Murphy's Coming to America, Marlon Brando's A Dry White Season, Sean Connery's The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, James Earl Jones' Cry, The Beloved Country, and Clint Eastwood's Invictus. A film documentary titled On Tiptoe, Gentle Steps to Freedom, the story of Ladysmith Black Mambazo, was nominated for an Academy Award. It's really nice. The group's most recent CD, Songs from a Zulu Farm, that's nearly not correct because their most recent CD is Ladysmith Black Mambazo singing for peace live around the world. That's the most recent one. But anyway, the CD, which is really wonderful, Songs from a Zulu Farm, is a collection of traditional tunes from their youth in South Africa. The CD recreates the idyllic world in which the members once lived. Ladysmith Black Mambazo will be releasing a children's CD late in 2013 called Stories and Songs from a Zulu Farm, in which they've created a narrative story to join with their recent songs for children to better understand life on a Zulu farm. That should be nice. This will be their first children's CD since the 1990s. As well, and they've already released a live CD called Singing for Peace Around the World, and that was released early this year, and it's still early. It's March. And then next year, they're going to release a traditional Zulu CD and an all-English American gospel recording with a famous American singer. That should be interesting. I wonder who that's going to be. So now, without further ado, I'm going to play this great interview that I had with Albert last week. and looking forward, we're going to actually have our show on Friday. It's going to be playing a little bit earlier than usual because I thought I had, gosh, you know what? Oh my goodness! I hope I have uploaded Albert's interview. Otherwise, I've just been tempting you and I'm not going to be able to play it. Oh, no, because I don't know if I have it. I hope I did. Albert. Yeah, I'm pretty sure I did. Anyway, I've got to find it. In the meantime, otherwise I'm going to have to play it another time. Oh, darn. I hate to do that to you, but I've got to run. I might not have it here. Okay, I've got to look a little more carefully. Darn, I just lost my train of thought. Okay, I'm gonna play African Tapestry while I look for my interview that might not be here. Oh my goodness, I thought I uploaded it, but I'm not seeing it. Oh shoot. Well, I have to play it next time. On Friday, we're gonna broadcast a little earlier. We're gonna broadcast at 6 a.m. Pacific time because we're having a sister-to-sister visit to the women's prison in Chowchilla, California, and so. We will be on the road, and I'm one of the visiting team, so we're going to have to broadcast a little bit earlier. And so we might have a special broadcast on Thursday and then rebroadcast it on Friday. So stay tuned. Visit blogtalkradio.com/Wanda's-picks. And you know what? I don't think I have Albert's interview here. Oh, my gosh. Darn. Well, we're going to close out. With, oh, man, I don't believe this. We're going to close out with African Tapestry, Prayer for a Continent, and I will play Albert's interview first thing on the next broadcast. Peace and blessings.
Barasuwayo!